KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
It's time for the Fish Report here on KSDP. We've got no new harvest numbers for the Alaska Peninsula as fishing was closed, but we do have updates for the Bristol Bay area as well as Kodiak, as well as escapement for the Alaska Peninsula. Let's start with the fish report for the in-harvest summaries from Bristol Bay for the 19th of June, 2025. Yesterday, a total of 81,000 sockeye were harvested. Cumulative total is now 313,000 to date. Ugashik had 25,000 for a total of 94,000. Egigik, 48,000 for a total of 182,000. Naknek, 6,000 for a total of 34,000. And Togiak with 1,000 for a total of 1,700. If we're going back into the way back machine, looking at this time last year, we can see that by this time in 2024, there had only been 30,000 sockeye harvested, so they are ahead of this time last year. Moving over to the Alaska Peninsula Weir Report. Yesterday, there was a total of 10,500 sockeye up the Chignik system for a total of 110,000 to date, doubling any year prior or post 2017. Nelson had 11,000 fish go up the Weir for a total of 34,000, which is now six times larger than the nearest year in the last 10. 1,700 in the Bear River for a total of 7,800 to date, putting in a nice middle upper range. Illinois River with 141 for a total of 11,000, putting in the mid-range, and Orzinski had 320 fish up the Weir yesterday. They're now at 500 to date, which is about 500 more than the last 10 years. Illyuk had no new fish. They're at 23. The Kodiak Management Area, they had a total of 1,900 fish harvested yesterday on the 19th of June. That was 173 sockeye. They're at 36,000 to date. 1,700 chum for a total of 61,000. So nearly a 2-to-1 ratio there for chum to sockeye over in the Kodiak Management Area. And that will do it for now for the Fish Report. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up right now on KSDP.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new welcome center in the town of Blue River, Oregon, had its grand opening last week. The Mackenzie Crossing and Native Center is located in the geographic heart of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. It's also in an area hit by the 2020 Holiday Farm Fire.
I wanted to create something up the Mackenzie River and Blue River to help it heal.
Catherine Kia Wilson is a bicultural liaison for the center, with connections to many tribal communities, including Native students she's mentored at the University of Oregon's Longhouse. Although the grand opening competed with other events on June 14th, including the No Kings rallies, Wilson was pleased at those who made it.
We had over 50 people there, a wonderful celebration.
The center will show how many tribes cross through the area for gathering, camping, and traveling to the obsidian cliffs along the coast. Wilson's grand plan is to establish a film center for Native people, where they can learn how to make original films.
At this point, I broke the ice, so to speak. And it's time for the tribes to step in. If they want this to happen, I'm here. But it's too big for this little old lady. But that was the dream.
Wilson says she's working with Native grant and business writers to make the film center a reality. And now we continue yesterday's story from KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio about how tribes along the Colorado River are faring under President Trump.
Uncertainty is still rippling from top to bottom, with So pointing out that the White House had yet to nominate a reclamation commissioner. That was until the Trump administration tapped Ted Cook, who once managed the Central Arizona Project, to potentially lead the Bureau.
They're still filling out the political roster interior quite a bit.
Daniel Cordalis, who is also Navajo, runs the Tribal Water Institute at the Native American Rights Fund. Settlements are hugely important legal frameworks for tribes in securing their water rights by basically turning paper claims into guaranteed acre-feet allocations, along with the funding mechanisms needed to do so. Such agreements, largely bipartisan, can only be ratified by Congress.
And of course, tribal waters are not the president's priorities. It's not uncommon, you know, that being said, I think we have an Interior Secretary who's sympathetic and supportive of tribes.
During his confirmation hearing, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum was hopeful he can deliver results for all along the Colorado River.
I've got some good understanding and good exposure to this, but I think you can count on that we're going to look for a collaborative solution that serves everyone.
But even if Burgum is behind tribes, getting the GOP-controlled Congress on board could still be challenging. Cordalis says slashing federal dollars may have a trickle-down effect, stalling Indian water settlements.
Congress is very much on the president's playbook about cutting costs, reducing the budget, and doing things and requiring, for lack of a better word, offsets.
The biggest offset of them all would be the Northeastern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement for Navajos, Hopis, and San Juan Southern Paiutes. It's worth $5 billion, an expense that the federal government incurs.
Where do you offset that? And who's going to do it? That's the concern here. These settlements have big price tags.
So is slightly more optimistic. She thinks the Trump administration sees this settlement for the three tribes in northeastern Arizona as an economic driver.
For the most amount of acres and the largest populations of tribes in the country.
The first Trump administration ratified the nation's most expensive Indian water settlement to date, valued at $1.9 billion.
That tells me, at least from the federal perspective, the first Trump administration understood the investment in Indian water.
But that all happened before Trump began focusing on so-called government efficiency. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Every fire wants every resource you have, but we only have so many airplanes, so many firefighters.
Officials in the interior warn residents they may need to evacuate due to nearby wildfires. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 20th. Good evening, I'm Hannah Floor. Also tonight, a bike relay between Alaska and Canada sees a dip in participation.
It's been going on since 1993, and it's all about the goodwill between Americans and Canadians.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
You're going to be hearing a lot from Senator Lisa Murkowski on national news outlets in the coming weeks. She has a book coming out next week. It's a political memoir called Far From Home. So she's going on all the shows, CBS Sunday Morning, The New York Times, The Daily, and in a few days, All Things Considered. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin got an advance copy and is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Liz.
Hey there.
What's in the book?
Well, Murkowski traces all the major moments in her political life, how she got the Senate seat from her dad, her wild write-in campaign in 2010, the controversy over the Supreme Court confirmation vote of Brett Kavanaugh. Many Alaskans remember that. The two impeachment votes, one where she voted to convict Donald Trump. And if you followed all of these events in real life, it's interesting to hear what was going on in her head at the time, or for me on the other side side of the microphone. And no matter how closely you followed it, you are going to hear some surprises.
Hmm. Did you enjoy it? Is it a good book?
Oh, it's a good read. Her co-author is Charles Walforth. He's a longtime Anchorage journalist, and the two of them go way back. I believe he represented her on the Anchorage Assembly before she went into politics, if I've got the timing right. They've been doing interviews and just sort of long talks for years for this book. He's a talented writer. He had tremendous access. And he told me, for instance, that he was at the Capitol for the first impeachment trial, and she just told him what was going on behind the scenes as it was happening.
Hmm. Wow, that is incredible access.
Yeah. Also, this book is more down to earth than you might expect from a U.S. senator. She recounts in the very introduction of the book a few years ago when she landed at Newtok to check on the progress of that village's relocation upriver. This is her reading from the audiobook. We got it from the publisher Penguin Random House.
We would go see the new barge landing at McTarvik that had been built as part of a military training exercise. But first, I had to use the toilet. The community hall had no facilities, so one of the leaders took me to the home of the mayor's mother.
So, as Murkowski tells it, they go to this rundown plywood home, and there are two women doing beadwork at the kitchen table. There are only two rooms in this house. A sleeping room and a, you know, room for everything else. So right there in the kitchen, as Murkowski tells it, is a bucket with a toilet seat on top.
This was the so-called honey bucket. The ladies chatted with me cheerfully as I sat down and as I reached for the toilet paper, which was resting next to me on the stovetop. Families would dump honey buckets such as this one in a sewage lagoon near the school at the edge of the village. I thought they deserved better.
Hannah, in all my years of writing about the infrastructure challenges in rural Alaska and the billions spent to try to move beyond the honey bucket, I had never read such a personal account of just what it's actually like to use a honey bucket in a family home.
Mm, yeah, yeah, it's really evocative. So Murkowski has become a very well-known political figure nationally. She's known for her moderation and for standing up to President Trump. Does she explore that in the book, explore how she ended up in that position?
She does. And she talks a lot about how that 2010 race where she won on a write-in, how that liberated her from the constraints of the party. Sometimes she just describes her position as a given, like accepting the reality of climate change when so many other Republicans don't. Sometimes her explanations are so succinct that I have more questions.
Mm. You've covered her a lot. Are you in the book?
Yeah, a teeny bit. She or Charles said some very nice things about this show, Alaska News Nightly, and its statewide reach. The book recounts a segment that the usual host, Casey Grove, and I recorded at the height of the Kavanaugh controversy. It's when I asked her if she had ever had her own Me Too moment. She said yes in such a way that it was clear I could not ask anymore. But her parents, Frank and Nancy Murkowski, heard that segment, and they asked her about it. And she eventually told them the story of something that happened when she was a child. And it's a pretty sad moment.
Wow. And she goes through all of that in the book.
Yes, she does, even though she says that she had never told anybody before, even her sisters, when it happened.
Mm, that's incredible. What else is in the book? Does it get gossipy? Does it get juicy?
She says that she was not writing a book to gossip or to seek retribution. But yeah, she doesn't hide her disdain for Sarah Palin. She says she was embarrassed to have her represent, you know, Alaska as John McCain's running mate in the presidential race. She says Donald Trump was not equipped for leadership. And she recounts a truly bizarre meeting in the Oval Office where she was there to talk about Alaska issues. They did. But he also brought up, of all things, her hair. He made several comments about her hair.
Huh. And when is the book out? If people want to know more about this incident, all the rest of the stuff that's in it. When does it come out?
The book is going to be out on Tuesday. There's a book event at the Anchorage Museum on the 30th. I'm told that's sold out, but I suspect there will be other book events around the state.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That was Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin talking about Senator Lisa Murkowski's new book, Far From Home. It was written with Charles Walforth, published by Penguin Random House. Thunderstorms yesterday afternoon started a dozen new fires in the interior, including a wildfire in the Gilmore Trail neighborhood of Northeast Fairbanks that triggered an evacuation. And during the night, the Fairbanks North Starboro notification system issued other evacuation preparation warnings. Some fires, like the Lake George Fire east of Delta Junction, were small. Others were larger, like the 12-mile Lake Fire, also east of Delta. It got to 100 acres last night, burning in black spruce and brush. But it's the biggest fires that are pulling on the resources of the Federal Alaska Fire Service and the Alaska Division of Forestry. Sam Harrell is an information officer for forestry. He says equipment and people are being prioritized to protect life and property among the emerging incidents.
Every fire wants every resource you have, but we only have so many airplanes, so many firefighters, and so much ground to move everything around.
For example, the Gilmore Creek Trail on the northeast side of Fairbanks received a lot of resources.
The Gilmore Trail was a very important fire because of the proximity to all the folks that live on that hillside up there and the potential for fire to move quickly in that area.
Harrell said evacuation orders are carefully calculated. People in harm's way are given as much warning as possible in case firefighting equipment can't get there fast enough.
Everybody needs and wants to be protected, but it's a scale of numbers, and it's very challenging.
The Bear Creek Fire near Healy, north of Denali National Park, is still burning today. Last night, the fire was within 3 miles of dog teams and multiple cabins and structures, so water scoopers and air tankers were ordered, and a fire crew from Anderson went to the scene. There's a larger fire closer to Fairbanks on the hillside near the Bonanza Creek area, about 30 miles from town. Last night, it was 350 acres and burning in continuous black spruce and hardwoods. Travelers coming to Fairbanks for Solstice weekend should watch for emergency vehicles, fire crews, and heavy equipment in the area. But right now, there are no plans to close the park's highway. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka artist prepares to show his latest paintings at a famous local dive bar.
These paintings are they're more tactile, the paint's thicker. The artist is clearly having more fun. That would be me.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers new and transfer students a wide range of scholarships, grants, and other financial assistance. Apply for admission to be considered automatically for most scholarships, and complete your financial aid application by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A woman who struck and killed a man riding a bicycle in South Anchorage last night was driving drunk, according to police. 40-year-old Stephanie Dill faces charges including manslaughter, DUI, reckless driving, and bribery in the C Street collision, court records show. A charging document against Dill says traffic cameras recorded her SUV heading north in C Street's southbound lanes before veering across the median and striking the cyclist. The man died at the scene near West Dowling Road shortly after 9 p.m. He hasn't been named as police notify his family. Dill allegedly told police to, quote, just arrest her. As she was being taken to jail, police said she twice offered an officer $1,000 to let her go. About 5 hours after the crash, Dill allegedly provided a breath sample with nearly twice Alaska's legal alcohol content for driving. Dill is being held today at the Highland Mountain Correctional Center. She was set to make an initial court appearance this afternoon. The cyclist is the second person killed this month by a driver in Anchorage. So far this year, Anchorage drivers have struck and killed 9 people on local roads. The Coalition for Education Equity is preparing to sue the state over what it says is inadequate funding for public schools in Alaska. The group decided to sue after Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed more than $50 million this month from the state's per-pupil education funding formula. Executive Director Caroline Storm says the nonprofit is convening multiple districts around the state as plaintiffs and plans to file the lawsuit within the next few months.
There's a certain amount of confidence that this line item veto will be overridden in January. However, that's too late, and it's still not enough.
Education funding was a top priority for Alaska lawmakers this session, who passed a $700 increase to the state formula, known as the base student allocation. After lawmakers overrode Dunleavy's veto of the bill, Dunleavy used his line item veto last week to reduce that to $500 per student. School leaders and lawmakers denounced the veto, but lawmakers are unlikely to have a chance to override it until the legislature reconvenes in January, when schools are halfway through the year. Storton says the lawsuit will draw from U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason's 2012 ruling in the Moore case, filed by the same group. That ruling determined that state funding for school districts was inadequate. Storm hopes this lawsuit will have a similar result.
Adequacy is, what does it take to give a child the opportunity, a reasonable opportunity, to learn the content of the standards that has been set by the state?
Storm declined to name which districts will file as plaintiffs, but said several districts support the suit because they're unsure how they can continue without an increase in state funding. More than 900 cyclists are set to participate this weekend in an annual cross-border race that starts in Canada and ends in Haines. But as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, this year's competition could look a little different amid ongoing political tensions between the U.S. and Canada.
The Kluane Chilkat International Bike Relay has been happening for decades, and it has a particular legacy.
So it's been going on since 1993, and it's all about the goodwill between Americans and Canadians.
That's Richard Clement. He's the vice president of the organization behind the race, which draws people from Alaska, Canada, and beyond year after year. The 150-mile course starts in Haines Junction, Canada, and ends in Haines, Alaska. The event is capped at 1,200 people. Most ride as members of relay teams, though some race the entire route solo. Usually, it sells out within 2 weeks, but that didn't happen this year. About 930 riders signed up.
We suspect it was Canadians who just didn't want to come to the U.S. But, you know, there's other factors too, like the exchange rate. It's unbelievably bad for Canadians to come down and change to American dollars these days.
Still, the vast majority of this year's registered participants, around 85%, are Canadian, according to race organizers. Clement says they also heard from a small number of Canadian teams, about a dozen, who did register and plan to race. But they're choosing not to finish the event because they don't want to cross the border into the U.S. That was the impetus behind a new policy posted to the race website on June 13th to accommodate those participants. It says cyclists must travel southbound only, and that those who don't want to cross the border must withdraw from the race no later than checkpoint 6. At that point, or sooner, cyclists must get into their team vehicles and drive home, as opposed to riding back toward Haines Junction.
For safety considerations, we tried to explain to them, don't turn around and try to ride your bike home. We cover people going to Haines. We don't cover people going the other way.
The policy adds that those who withdraw early will be marked as DNF, or did not finish. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
IBEW's path to success includes excellent training, good wages, benefits, and a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
For the second year in a row, Nome hosted the 1,800-passenger Westerdam cruise ship yesterday. KNOM's Ben Townsend polled a few passengers for their take on the historic town.
We already had three talks with people living here. Friendly. It was so nice. Friendly. And it was so nice to talk to them. Very, very welcome. We feel very welcome here.
That's Paula and Rob from Amsterdam. The Dutch duo is standing feet from the Iditarod's iconic Broad Arch finish line. Rob says he's seen the sled dog race on TV, but never in person.
You see these harsh environments, the weather and the snow and the dogs and how they can survive that.
After a quick stop in Dutch Harbor, the Westerdam floated up to Nome through calm waters but overcast skies. For Connor Lomersee from Florida, Nome's 50-degree temps and blue skies was a welcome change.
Some of the sea days we have on the cruise ship, it's been raining and foggy, so yeah.
Just good to get off the boat.
Yes, after like 3 or 4 days.
Retiree Gail Kishida says the time on the ship doesn't faze her. These days, she and her husband Gary live on cruise ships.
This is fantastic. We went to Sitka, Ketchikan, and Valdez, and they're all wonderful. But this, the people are so friendly, and we're just having a great time.
On the north side of town, the floor of Nome's Recreation Center has turned into a buzzing marketplace. Local vendors are selling blueberry jam, hand-sewn cuspucks, and traditional beaded earrings. Sherry Zarnecki from New York bought moose print fabric and earrings while in town. She says everywhere she's visited, people have been friendly.
That makes it so pleasant to visit when you feel welcome and not feeling like we're infiltrating, you know. So it really is a warm community.
Back at the harbor, the last few passengers and crew board the final tender destined for the big ship. Organizing the shoreside activities is Robin Johnson.
A lot of people don't realize what a gold mining community we are. So they think all the dredges out there are fishing boats. I heard that several times today. And when I told them, no, those are suction dredges, That's amazing to him.
Johnson says a similarly sized Holland America cruise is already booking for next year. In Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
A new exhibit of contemporary portraiture is opening in Sitka, but don't bother looking for it in any of the community's excellent museums or galleries. This show opens in one of Alaska's most famous watering holes, Sitka's Pioneer Bar. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka artist Steve Lowry has been around a long time, and his acclaim has grown along with the size of his portraits, huge canvases that focus almost exclusively on the faces of his subjects. And while these faces are not often glamorous, every line tells us the story of who they are. So naturally, the best place for Lowry to hang his new exhibit is in a bar.
Every now and again, we go in there for a beer and some fish and chips. and we have mutual friends that we meet there. And Maite was looking around at the place and pointed out that this would be a good venue for paintings. And the more I thought about it, the more courage I got to do it. So she kind of kicked me into this and cracks the whip on the project, you know.
Maite Lorente is Lowry's friend and curator, and sometimes collaborator. They partnered 2 years ago for an exhibit of paintings and writings inspired by the lives of Pam and Eric Beeler, who disappeared together from their home near Pelican in 2018. That exhibit, called The Squirrel and Bear, was mounted in a more conventional space with people slowly milling through, sipping wine and eating cheese. Certainly, there will be wine at the opening of This Thing We Call the Ocean. And over the run of the show, there will be pool, beer, and all the usual delights served up by Rita and her staff behind the bar. Lowry began his career in Sitka as a commercial troller, and This Thing We Call the Ocean is an homage to fishing and to maritime culture. The Pioneer Bar is probably ground zero of that culture in Sitka, if not the ideal space for art.
Fishing's been here a long time. We have these other powerful economic drivers in town, our tourism, our search hospital. But fishing's always there. It's like a stainless steel backbone, if you like.
Cruise tourism and healthcare are both growing in the region, but Laurie is correct that fishing binds everything together in Southeast Alaska, and Laurie's portraits demonstrate that the people who work in fishing bind communities together.
Some of those people unload the boats. Some of those people catch the fish. Some of those people repair the boats. There are paintings of boats at sea with usually gnarly looking water, you know, because half the time it is. So I'm trying to revitalize or refocus our Sitka look at fishing.
The show features 28 portraits in all. Those already familiar with Laurie's work won't be disappointed, but they may also be surprised. Decades into his craft, Laurie says he's continuing to evolve. Maybe he's even loosened up a bit.
In this exhibition, there's two old paintings. By old, I mean like 20 years or 25 years ago. A couple of portraits. And then there's one more recent portrait. And they are strikingly different to these paintings. These paintings are the more tactile, the paint's thicker. The artist is clearly having more fun. That would be me. And they're heavier with the paint and more bold.
Others visiting the bar who've never heard of Laurie may chafe a little. On any typical day, the Pioneer Bar is an unofficial maritime museum with hundreds of photos of fishing boats representing several eras of fishing in Sitka from the early 20th century onward. Those photos aren't going anywhere. Laurie is just borrowing the wall space for a while. When his portraits come down, he expects that bar patrons will see the photos with a fresh eye.
Paintings are different than photos, but there's two art shows going on there, essentially.
This Thing We Call the Ocean, a show of 28 large canvases by Stephen Laurie, opens at 3 p.m. on June 21st in the Pioneer Bar in Sitka and runs through July 6th. Reporting in Sitka with help from Brooke Schaefer, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Skagway is a small town, but it celebrates Pride Month in a big way. June is full of events ranging from the Rainbow Roll, that's a roller skating party at the Recreation Center, to the legendary drag show that welcomes local and state drag performers. KHNS reporter Melinda Munson takes a look at some of this year's colorful offerings.
Pride Month in Skagway starts with an official proclamation. Here's then-Mayor Sam Bass.
And whereas Pride celebrations honor the history of LGBTQIA+ activism while standing boldly for a future where love, identity, and belonging are visible and valued across every race, age, ability, and background, now, therefore, I, Samuel Bass, Mayor of the Municipality of Skagway, do hereby proclaim the 2025 Pride Festival.
Skagway has officially celebrated Pride since 2019. And this is the third year the public library has invited local drag kings and queens to story time. The event was called Love Who You Are. Gian Monroe, whose drag name is Petit Pierre, read from Pink is for Boys by Rob Perlman.
Purple is for boys and girls. And unicorns! Because... unicorns! I love unicorns.
Cody Burnham, a.k.a. Miss Frizzle at library events, read Daniel Hawke's Prince and Knight. In the story, the court expects the prince to marry a princess, but instead, he meets his knight in shining armor.
The prince met many ladies, and he made them all swoon. But it was soon clear that he was singing a different tune. Thank you, he told his parents. I appreciate that you tried, but I'm looking for something different and a partner by my side.
This year, Lucy's Bakery hosted its first queer poetry night. Burnham emceed that gathering.
I think that poetry and queerness has always been really deeply connected. More than just an art form, it's been used for survival as a form of resistance and connection across generations.
High schooler Mina Yi was the youngest participant, with the exception of one baby. Yi read from Alaskan poet Mary Beth Holman's book, Tender Gravity.
Imagine being able to pull water from deep below to the surface where you live. Imagine being able to hold 40 times your weight of what you most require. What if it were love? What if you could hold 40 times your weight in love?
The month continues with the Gays of 98 show on June 28th, followed by Pride Dance Night at the Red Onion. In Chicago, I'm Melinda Munson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Robin in Fairbanks, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Ben Townsend in Nome, Rob Woolsey in Sitka, and Melinda Munson in Skagway. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Hannah Floor. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Baby, baby, it looks like it's gonna hail. Baby, baby, it looks like it's gonna hail. You better come inside, let me teach you how to jive and whirl. Oh, you gotta jump, jive, bend your way. Jump jive, bend your way, gotta jump jive, bend your way, gotta jump jive, bend your way, gotta jump jive, bend your way the way. Then you ain't got it.
Yeah. Don't, hell, I'll make it on my own. How about you?